Punjabi Hare Na. Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Hare. Gopi Jana Balabha Gravarir Hare. Gopi Jana Balabha Gravarir Hare. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari.
Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Bhavaraja Kachara Satara Sata Shri Shima's Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Nandakurta Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. All gloriously simple devotees, all gloriously simple devotees, all gloriously simple devotees, all gloriously Shri Guru and Shri Guranga. Om Namo Prabhupada. Om Vishvaraya Krishna Sagrade Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamani Namaste Sarasvadim Gauravana Bhajrani Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paskatari Zitarani. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 2, canto 2, chapter 7, text 43 through 45, in scattered incarnations. So there's three fairly long verses here, so I'll go through them once, and then why don't we have maybe three people on one side do one verse apiece that we can do responsibly, and then go through it once more. Okay? Otherwise, we'll be here all day chanting, which wouldn't be bad, but... Yeah. Okay, here we go. Vedaha manga paramasya hi yoga mayam.
Vedaha manga paramasya hi yoga mayam.
Yuyam bhavashcha bhagavan artadaitya varya.
Yuyam bhavashcha bhagavan artadaitya varya.
Patni manosacha manushcha tadamajascha. Prachini Bharhi Ribir Hangaruta Druvascha. Ikshvakur Aila Muchakunda Videha Gadhi. Raghvam Barisha Sagaragayana Husadya. Mandatra larka shatadan vanuranti deva. Deva vrato balira mur tarayo dalipa. Saubar yatanka shibi devalapi palada.
Saubar yatanka shibi devalapi palada.
Sarasvato Devaparashra Burishena. Yenye Vibhishana Hanuma Rupendra Datta. Kartartishtena Vidura Shruta Deva Varya. Maybe one verse apiece. Someone start? Anyone? Can you do the second verse? Why don't we go through and do the successive one, the next four lines, Iksha. Thank you. I'm just going to read the translation and purport. You'll see from the translation, most of this is the names of these people, so it's pretty self-apparent. Okay, translation purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. O Narada, although the potencies of Lord are unknowable and immeasurable, still, because we're all surrendered souls, we know how He acts through Yogamaya potencies. And similarly, the potencies of the Lord are also known to the all-powerful Shiva, the great king of the atheist family, namely Prahlad Maharaj, Swayambhuva Manu, his wife Shatarupa, his sons and daughters like Priyavrata, Uttanapad, Akuti, Devahuti, and Prashuti, Prachandabharhi, Ribhu, Anga, the father of Vena, Maharaj Dhruva, Ikshvaku, Ayla, Muchakunda, Maharaj Janaka, Gadhi, Raghu, Ambarish, Sagara, Gaya, Nahusha, Mandata, Alarka, Shatadanve, Anu, Rantidev, Bhishma, Bali, Amurtaraya, Dilipa, Shaubari, Utanka, Shibi, Devala, Pipalada, Sarasvata, Uddhava, Parashara, Burishena, Vibhishana, Hanuman, Shukadev Goswami, Arjuna, Aristasena, Vidura, Shrutadev, etc. Okay, a lot of familiar names and some not so familiar, at least to me. Purport. All the great devotees of the Lord, as mentioned above, who flourished... I'm sorry?
The last line you read earlier.
Oh, I've got it. different version here. Can somebody read that? It's not under.
Because we all are surrendered, so we know how the Lord acts through His potencies.
Yeah, that's very important. In what I was reading home, I had that, but this book doesn't have. It's a different edition or something.
Well, it says it in the beginning of the verse in the book.
Oh, maybe just change it around. Okay, so change the order of it around.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, we'll get to that. That's a very important concept. All right. Purport. All the great devotees of the Lord, as mentioned above, who flourished in the past or present, and all the devotees of the Lord who will come in the future, are aware of the different potencies of the Lord, along with the potency of His name, quality, pastimes, entourage, personality, etc. And how do they know? Certainly it is not by mental speculation, nor by any attempt by dint of limited instruments of knowledge. By the limited instruments of knowledge, either the senses or the material instruments like microscopes and telescopes, one cannot even fully know the Lord's material potencies, which are manifested before our eyes. For example, there are millions and billions of planets, far, far beyond the scientist's calculation. But these are only the manifestations of the Lord's material energy. What can the scientists hope to know of the spiritual potency of the Lord by such material efforts? Mental speculations by adding some dozens of ifs and maybes cannot add to the advancement of knowledge. I'm sorry, cannot aid the advancement of knowledge. On the contrary, such mental speculations will only end in despair by dismissing the case abruptly and declaring the non-existence of God. The sane person, therefore, ceases to speculate on subjects beyond the jurisdiction of his tiny brain, and as a matter of course, he tries to learn to surrender unto the Supreme Lord, who alone can lead one to the platform of real knowledge. In the Upanishads, it is clearly said that the Supreme Personality of Godhead can never be known simply by working very hard and taxing the good brain, nor can he be known simply by mental speculation and jugglery of words. The Lord is knowable only by one who is a surrendered soul. Herein, Ramaji, the greatest of all material living beings, acknowledges this truth. Therefore, the fruitless spoiling of energy by pursuing the path of experimental knowledge must be given up. One should gain knowledge by surrendering unto the Lord and by acknowledging the authority of the persons mentioned herein. The Lord is unlimited, and by the grace of the Yoga Maya, helps the surrendered soul to know Him proportionately with the advance of one's surrender. Om Gyan Kimrandisha Gananjana Salapaya Chaksarun Mitamina Tasmai Sri Gurve Namaha Vanchakalpa Trubhischa Kripa Sindhu Devicha Patitano Pavane Bhyo Vaishnavayo Namaha. So we have actually a series of the last two verses in these three that are giving sort of the summation after we have heard about the whole list of incarnations. And they're all describes at least many of the different Leela avatars and other incarnations that are coming. This is all, of course, recited by Lord Brahma to Narada Muni. Verse 41, 2 days ago, was saying it was impossible to know Krishna. You probably remember that one. Prachurananda give that class? He was talking about, anyway, how there's just so much that we can't know. Even our material science is very limited, etc. And even they are saying, even those great personalities cannot really know Krishna in full, incomplete. And it was described how Sheshanaga, with 10,000, with 1,000 heads, could recite the pastimes of the Lord without ever repeating or without ever coming to an end. Then verse 42 said, but yet it is possible. It is possible by those who are favored by the Lord due to their surrender to Him. And then again, today's verse says that there are many great devotees in the past who have understood. And how? They've understood through Yogamaya potencies. So on one hand, the great devotees know Krishna, and on the other hand, no one, even the greatest devotees, cannot completely know. So it's somewhat of a paradox. We can't know, but we can know. And, of course, Krishna consciousness is based on paradoxes. if you're uncomfortable with paradoxes and things being this way or that way, then, you know, it's unfortunate, because you have to, your mind, your intelligence has to be a little flexible to grasp Krishna consciousness. Isn't it all based on, what's the greatest paradox our philosophy is based on? Chintabhedita-vedita-tattva, right? Simultaneous oneness and difference. You have to, in, the intelligence has to somehow conceive of two things that are opposing and be able to synthesize those into some coherent framework of thought and cognition. Now, can we do that totally? Of course not. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, because it is really only by Krishna's mercy and the yogamaya potency that enables one to be able to realize Krishna. So this is, of course, a philosophical question of epistemology. Epistemology is a branch of philosophy that talks about knowledge and knowing. What is knowledge? How do we determine what is true? And what are the limits of knowledge? How much can we know? And in the past, of course, philosophy has been very dominated by the theories of rationalism or empiricism, or as Prabhupada would often call them, inductive and deductive knowledge. Now, it's not that these processes aren't something that one can use. Of course one can. We have to use, when you even think about empiric knowledge, we use it all the time. I mean, we say sometimes we're very diminishing of the scientific method, but, you know, if I'm growing my fruit trees, I find out, you know, I discover that if I don't get enough water, they don't produce well, this doesn't, you know, so you learn. These are, you know, experimental, you could say, different processes where we do acquire some knowledge, but of course, it's very limited. Now, in the Vedas, the different types of evidence are mentioned in 11:19-17, in the Uddhava Gita, it says, Shruti prakshasham atiham anumanam chatushtayam praman vesh anavashtanat vikalpatsa virajite. Four types of evidence: Vedic knowledge, Shruti, direct experience, prajaksha, traditional wisdom is aitihya. Am I saying that right? Aitihyam, traditional wisdom, and anumana, logical induction. So these four are there. One can understand the by these, one can understand the temporary, insubstantial situation in the material world by which one becomes detached from the duality of this world. So it's actually described there that to some degree one can use all of these forms of knowledge to get some understanding. Shruti obviously is Vedic evidence directly given by God, which is unquestionable, and that's the highest. But we have prajaksha, traditional wisdom, logical induction. And this application is given to the temporary nature of the material world, that question. And so this is a positive application of those types of knowledge. But there are also limitations, and those are also discussed. And Sri Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Goswami explain these somewhat more. So Vishwanath is an example of how these pramans, or these ways of knowing, of wisdom, substantiate the idea the world is temporary. That was what the verse was talking about. So this is an interesting example. He says, by observation, we see buildings, bodies, empires come and go. A clay is made into a pot, destroyed, and then returns to clay. So by observation, we see, you know, things come and go. Then there's traditional wisdom. Think of sayings like, everything is temporary, the only constant is change. So there's an intuitive sense that people have that things are not permanent. And by logic, we conclude that everything is impermanent by inference. In other words, everything we've seen is impermanent, everything I've known, everyone I know has died in the past. Why would I not think that everything is impermanent and things come to an end? So you can use all these types of evidence to a certain extent, but they still may not give us the absolute truth. Why? Well, because they have limitations. And these, first of all, these ways of knowing may be mutually contradictory. And something like, for example, there may be a discrepancy between traditional ideas and wisdoms and experimental or scientific knowledge. Those things are sometimes into conflict. And obviously, many things be in conflict with Shruti or Shabda Brahman. Now, this idea of common sense or folk wisdom is very popular. I think particularly in America, it's gotten more and more popular to basically discount anything of any scientific evidence or intellectual understanding whatsoever, and simply go by one's gut feeling of what me and all my other friends here in Lancaster County think. Anyway, It's called naive psychology or naive realism in sociology and psychology. Naive realism is a human tendency to believe that we see the world around us objectively. I see it objectively how it is, and people who disagree with me must be uninformed, irrational, or biased, or foolish. You know, something wrong with anyone else. So anyway, we can even see if these common cultural sayings or adages, you know, that people kind of think, yeah, that really explains it, but they're very contradictory. Like, there's one adage that says, absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? Then also, out of sight, out of mind. See, these totally contradict each other. Opposites attract, or birds of a feather flock together. Anyway, so these are not very valuable in the pursuit of knowledge. Now, the main, I would say, process of knowledge acquisition that we have in this modern material world is really prachakṣa, which is inductive knowledge, or the ascending knowledge of scientific knowledge, experimental knowledge, so many ways you could look at it, or observational knowledge. What are the limitations of that? Prabhupada has told us many times, and in fact, that he's talking about in his purport very extensively about the limitations of knowledge, the limitations of our senses. Of course, the four defects. We make mistakes, we have imperfect senses, we tend to cheat, and we are an illusion. So, imperfect senses, obviously, we probably to give an example, you can't even see what's behind you. You put a stick of glass in the water and it appears bent, right? Because of the refraction of light through the water. So we can't rely a lot on our senses to give us truth, even about material energy, what to speak of spiritual insight. We can't see light waves, radio waves, all these things that we sort of accept on faith. Does anyone really hear, unless you're a complete, you know, IT expert, does anyone know, you really know how the internet works? I've never been able to figure it out. You know, it's like, it's a mystery. You know, so many things that we don't understand. Of course, one of the interesting points is, though, we accept on authority. Because we think someone who knows more than me, who's really studied this, they know, and I read it in a book, or I read it on an internet site, and I believe it, because I think they're an authority. So, and Prabhupada gives the point that even if there are instruments that advance our senses and increase the techniques and extend the range of our senses, like telescopes or microscopes, they still may be built on the wrong premises, and they simply compound the mistake. In other words, and they're also based upon our interpretation. It's still the same material senses and mind that must interpret all of this information and try to make sense of it in our world. Of course, the other thing is cheating, or sometimes it's just bluffing. You know, it's very speculative, it's always changing. You know, if you read any textbook, you'll probably any high school, or they'll make it sound like, say, evolution is pretty much something that they've proven or something that's established, right? And that there's general consensus by scientists. I mean, I've seen several different surveys, and so I'm not saying this is the absolute one, but in this range, I've seen different surveys that show up to 55% of scientists don't even believe Darwinian theory. Now, that doesn't mean that they all think that all was created by God, but it means there's so many holes in the theory that they can't really accept it as a reasonable explanation for the development of the species that we see on this planet. So, and of course, the knowledge is always changing. Hundreds of years ago, people thought the Earth was flat. Of course, Vedic knowledge has known about globes floating in space for eternity, thousands and thousands of years. Germ theory, when that was first even came up with them, in the 1800s, Louis Pasteur and that. Subatomic particles, protons, neutrons, which we take for granted, they discovered those in 1953. And that's after I was born, so that's a long time ago. So, you know, you can just see. And of course, they do explain it somewhat. They say that it's a tentative nature of science, of theories, that we're always improving, always increasing, which really means that they don't know conclusively. That's why they're called theories. Nobody says the fact of, they say the theory of, which means this is our best guess at this point. So none of this is very conclusive. And there's additional issues. First of all, the main thing is spiritual topics are beyond direct experience. Most philosophical, metaphysical, or spiritual questions cannot be answered by direct experience. They're not something, you know, like, you know, at least most people, If you're very fortunate, maybe you've experienced, you know, God and all these things, if you're a great devotee, but most people have not. They don't know. We don't know what the... These are metaphysical questions. What is life about? What is this world? What is there a future life? Is there God? Who has created all of this? You know, you're not going to go into your laboratory and find an answer to that. You know, these are far beyond the scope of that. And even if we understand everything about the material world and its interaction, the chemicals and the elements and all of that, we do not necessarily understand the underlying causation. For instance, creation. We don't know how it happened. I mean, they call it theories, the Big Bang, or, you know, there's several versions. There are different versions now. I think the Big Bang is maybe not the latest. But there's, you know, they have the Big Chill and the Big Bang, and a lot of these different ones. And, you know, but the point is, and I was thinking the other day, they're saying there was a Big Bang and everything sort of just came into being. Saying, well, it's kind of like Mahavishnu does it that way too, doesn't he? You know, it's like everything comes out of his pores and the whole thing, you know, all of the energies and the Mahatattva and Pradhana and all of these things, you know, come out. So, you know, maybe they're onto something there. But the thing is, they have no explanation. Even if it were true, and maybe that, you know, maybe it did kind of happen like that. Where did it come from? Where was the energy? Where were all these material, where were these ingredients? And who caused it? Or if nobody caused it, why? In other words, these are insignificant explanations because they don't know the real causes behind. So the creation, development, material world, there's two perspectives on it, and this is discussed a lot by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Jiva Goswami, that there's an immediate material cause, and there's which is called pradhana, and a remote or spiritual cause, which is called nimitta. And there's a verse from Adi 6:14. I won't read if anybody's interested. It says, I'll read the English. It says, just as the external energy consists of two parts, the efficient cause, nimitta, and the material cause, upadana, maya being the efficient cause and pradhana the material cause, so Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, assumes two forms to create the material world with efficient and material causes. Okay, so in other words, there's what's immediately happening, what we observe, what's happening with the material energy, and then there's the cause behind it. How is it happening? And ultimately, that's going to bring us back to Krishna, of course, to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, where all creation, everything is, it comes about, everything is manifested. He manipulates the energies in different ways, either directly or indirectly, through his agents like Lord Brahma, assembling all the ingredients and making it happen. But without that impetus, without that creative spark, the creative impetus that's coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, none of it would come into manifestation. Okay, so that's problematic there. And then, of course, logical arguments, rational arguments, and the Veda is called Anuman. You know, it's limited. It probably gives an example of a logic argument. All men are mortal. John is a man. Therefore, John is mortal. We can only get so far with that. As we know, I was thinking, I've been reading Chaitanya Bhagavat lately, and went through the several chapters, much more than in Chaitanya Charitamrita, about what they call Lord Chaitanya's scholastic pastimes. And he was, formidable as a debater and as a logician. He was like absolutely expert. No one even could believe it. They were almost beginning to, even the people who weren't very religious were thinking he might be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He was just that good. He would pose an argument, and they would say, oh, that sounds good. Then he would defeat his own argument and go, oh, okay, you're right. Then he would go back and reestablish it again, and you know, and nobody could stand up against him. Of course, Keshava Kashmiri was one of the most prominent examples, the greatest scholar probably in the country that he easily defeated, and you know, he rattles off 100 verses, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu could simply pick one and pick a couple, you know, grammatical faults in it. You know, it was astounding. But but then what happened? Was Lord Chaitanya really proud of this? Is this the way he wanted to bring Krishna consciousness to the world? Not really. After he, of course, this is all his pastime. At a certain point, he decided it was time to reveal himself. He begins little forays. Actually, he met Ishvara Puri first in Mayapur, or Navadvip. He was there for a while. Then he told Ishvara Puri to go to Prayag, and he would meet him later, which he did. So then he goes there, he takes initiation from Srila Ishvara Puri, and then he's totally manifests pure love of God. So the students come to, just a little bit of side here. The students come to their lessons, and all he does is talks about Krishna. And he was kind of in ecstatic trance for a few days doing this. But I said, what did I say? Was it good? And they go, oh, it was wonderful. We all liked it. It didn't have anything to do with, you know, our studies. It didn't have anything to do with logic. But, of course, it did. He showed how every word and every letter directly indicated Krishna. So he says, okay, I'm done. Wraps up his books. Says, I'm sorry, you're free to go and learn from somebody else. You know, I can't teach this anymore. And of course, many of them went with him. Many of them became his, they were his devotees, eternal, you know, associates. Many of them came with him and became part of the Sankirtan movement. So he showed us that this debating back and forth logic is not the way to truth. So he sort of abandoned that all and just took up the process of pure devotional service. Now, there are some proper uses of logic. There's one scripture we probably all know, which is called Nyaya Prasthana, based upon logic and argument. Has little short aphorisms, Vedanta Sutra. That's actually considered a logical argument for the establishment of Brahman, of the absolute truth. You know, well, Krishna ultimately. So, at any rate, we're not going to, Prabhupada says repeatedly in this purport, it's very clear that, you know, this is not the way that we're going to come to any understanding of the absolute truth. This is not how we're going to understand God. It's not how we're going to understand spiritual knowledge. It's very, very limited in its application. One can only know Krishna and his energies when he reveals them to us. So many great devotees here are mentioned, and Prabhupada says we must learn from these authorities through the descending process of knowledge. I just wanted to make a little side editorial comment. I don't know if any of you noticed that four of these great authorities were Vaishnavis, were women. We have Swayambhuva Manu's wife, Shatarupa, and his sons, and his daughters, Akuti, Devahuti, and Prasuti. Of course, two of them that I know of gave birth to incarnations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, right? Akuti's son was Jagna, and Devahuti's was Kapila. Kapila, married to Cardamom, yeah, Kapila. Okay, I'm not sure. Oh, I know. Prasuti was married to Daksha. So she was a great progenitor along with Daksha. Anyway, many, many great personalities described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So Krishna comes to deliver the conditioned soul, the jiva, out of his mercy. And that mercy comes primarily, well, it comes in many ways, but primarily to devotee in the form of the spiritual master. There was some discussion, oh, this was several months ago, that Krishna, although he has all mercy and he has all knowledge, he does not directly experience the pain and suffering of living entities because he can't. He's pure and perfect. He doesn't experience, you know, suffering. He's, you know, he's the personification of prema all the time. But he does have, he knows that we are suffering, and he's very merciful. That's one of his greatest qualities. Bhakti Vatsala, His mercy to his devotees is great quality. So he sends his representatives. He manifests his mercy through the saints, the sages, the guru. And of course, through the scriptures, his own incarnation. Many, many ways he does. But it's primarily that connection with his devotees, with his pure devotees, that connect the suffering living entity or the jiva, you know, to the process of Krishna consciousness. It's described that and the Sritashvara Upanishad, only to those great souls who have implicit faith in both the Lord and the spiritual master are all of the imports of Vedic knowledge automatically revealed. So it's interesting, automatically revealed. They are revealed. Knowledge is revealed. Knowledge isn't something, oh, well, I've learned it all. I've memorized all these verses, or I get all the things. You know, it's fortunately for me, it's not based on that. But at any rate, through the mercy of Krishna and Guru, all of knowledge is revealed to the devotee. So what's that process of hearing from authority? Of course, it's based upon bhakti, on devotion. We know bhakti mama vajanati yavanyashchasmi tatvataha tato mam tatvato gyatva vishite tadanantaram. One can understand me as I am, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, only by devotional service. When one is in full consciousness of me by such devotion, he can enter into the kingdom of God. Gita 1855. Now, another interesting point here is it's stated those surrendered souls, those devotees, can know him through his yogamaya potency. So what's yogamaya? Yogamaya is the internal potency, the spiritual energy, spiritual potency of Krishna. It's his own spiritual energy. Now, in the material world, because we're talking about still, we've still been talking about material cosmos and his incarnations and how he's acting here, there's two functions yogamaya has. One is to cover the living entities who wish to be forgetful of Krishna due to their desires, and also to enlighten those who wish to know about Krishna. So it has a potency of covering and also an uncovering. An uncovering? I don't know if there's a term for that. It's a spiritual word. But anyway, obviously, the covering potency, Bhagavad Gita 7:25, I'm never manifest to the foolish and unintelligent. For them, I am covered by my internal potency, and therefore they do not know that I am unborn infallible. Now, a nice description of how Yogamaya and Mahamaya work somewhat together in this material cosmos is given by Srila Prabhupada. It's an end note to 10.1. It's not a regular purport, but he puts these extra notes in the 10th canto, which are really nice. You know, he explains kind of, here's what's going on. Robert says, from this statement, it is to be understood that Yogamaya, in her partial expansion, becomes Mahamaya. Okay, Yogamaya expands as Mahamaya, and bewilders the conditioned souls. In other words, the entire creation has two divisions, transcendental or spiritual, and material. Yogamaya manages the spiritual world, and by her partial expansion as Mahamaya, she manages the material world. Durga is originally the spiritual potency, Hladini Shakti, by whose mercy one can understand the Supreme Person of Godhead very easily. Of course, Hladini Shakti is also known as Radharani. And, of course, then these are all, in other words, what do you call it, downline expansions of Radharani originally, you know, into Yogamaya and then, of course, Mahamaya. Hladini Shakti, by whose mercy one can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead very easily. The Mahamaya Shakti, however, is a covering of Yogamaya and is therefore called covering potency. By this covering potency, the entire material world is bewildered. In conclusion, bewildering the conditioned souls and liberating the devotees are both functions belonging to Yogamaya. Right. So that's why it's saying by the... what is it actually saying here? Well, if I can find it, since I don't have it. Okay, it says, we all know how he acts. We know how he acts through his Yogamaya potencies. Okay, so that kind of also indicates understanding how he acts both spiritually and materially, because both are known to a devotee. So, it's interesting. Our vision is covered by Krishna's own potency. One real example, nice example Prabhupada gives is example of the clouds and the sun. The clouds are created by the energy of the sun, right? The sun evaporates the water from the ocean, or the body of water comes up and becomes a cloud. The cloud covers our vision of the sun. The sun may burn away, and then the clouds reveals itself. So in other words, it was by the creation of the sun that the cloud covering came about, which covered our vision of the sun. In the same way, the sun can also, you know how it is, like it was so foggy this morning, you notice, and now it's like it's all gone, you know, mostly gone because the sun has come out and dissipated it. So similarly, Krishna's Yogamaya covers him from our vision, and by the same energy, he can reveal himself. So the great souls in this verse, due to their desire to purely serve, have realized spiritual knowledge by this grace of Yogamaya. So no one can fully understand Krishna. 100%. You know, Krishna says, I can hardly understand myself because I'm good. He's always expanding. He's always increasing. So, you know, as soon as he understands himself, he increases some more. So, it's very, very difficult. Although a great devotee, of course, basically the curtain of Maya is lifted. They understand all spiritual knowledge, but not every detail. No jiva is omniscient. No one can completely understand everything. You know, a devotee can have great understanding. Devotees can have a lot of power. And they can know so many things, whatever. I mean, Narada Muni, look, he's called Trikala Gya almost, right? He knows what's going to happen. He says it in the future. There's even some verses everywhere in the Bhagavatam where Narada Muni says, I foresee you're going to do this, 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 and this. He's talking about things that are going to happen in the future. So, but even Narada Muni can't know everything in every corner of the universe simultaneously. He can know whatever Krishna tells him, you know, of course. But no, Krishna has. So what we have to know and understand and accept is what's called the achinta shakti of the Lord. Because at a certain point, our intellect is going to fail. I discover that a lot. You know, you try to overthink things too much, you know, to a certain point, and it just kind of like, you know, you kind of like short out your intelligence. You just can't understand it anymore. You know, that's our limitation. And that's, but we have, if we understand the achinta shakti of the Lord, we can begin to sort of get a sense of how it's all coming together, how it's working. This is, I don't know what I'm reading. Brahma was mystified about Krishna's opulence, Nija Mahimani, because this opulence was atarkya, or inconceivable. With one's limited senses, one cannot argue about which is inconceivable. Therefore, the inconceivable is called achinta, that which is beyond chincha, or thought and argument. Achincha refers to that which we cannot contemplate, but have to accept. Srila Jiva Goswami said, unless we accept achinta in the Supreme, we cannot accommodate the conception of God. This must be understood. Therefore, we say the words of Shastra should be taken as they are, without change, since they are beyond our arguments. Now, there's a nice discussion about this achinta shakti, if anyone wants to follow this up more. By Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, there's a little book that's translated by Bhana Swami called Raga Vartma Chandrika. It's only two chapters, real quick, but it's really just amazing. It's a packed little book. Now, in chapter one talks about Raganuga Bhakti, but chapter two talks, really, he poses the problem, how can Krishna hear the prayers of his sadhakas all over the world? You know, we're all praying to Krishna, I hope, and we hope Krishna's hearing us, and we're pretty sure he is, because he's super soul situated in our hearts, right? So, but how can he do this when he's totally involved and absorbed in his pastimes with his intimate devotees in Vrindavan? He's with the coward boys, he's with the gopis, he's with Mother Yashoda, Nanda. And is Krishna simultaneously aware of all these things both going on? He has his Aishvarya aspect where he's maintaining the world, creations, he's Lord Narayan, he's the Purusha incarnations. And at the same time, he has this Madhurya aspect, Madhurya meaning the sense of sweetness, as we see in Vrindavan Leela, you know, while he's on the lap of Mother Yashoda, you know, appearing as a baby. And then he brings up the other point. In the Damodar Leela, when Mother Yashoda goes to bind him and he's crying, since he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is he just pretending to cry? Krishna says, no, he's not pretending to cry, he's really crying. So how can he be playing, I guess you could say, or, you know, acting in that relationship, in that rasa as a young child, and at the same time, he's over on the side here creating and destroying universes, you know, and everything else that Krishna does. You know, just all of his amazing incarnating into so many ways everywhere in the universe. So he's both omnipotent and he displays human-like pastimes in Vraja at the same, or in all of it, wherever he's performing pastimes. How is this done? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, who I think is probably more intelligent than all of us, says there's only one explanation, achinta shakti. It's the inconceivable potency of Krishna. He's able to do this in a way that our intelligence cannot compute. He's able to do both. He can be with each one of us individually. You ever think about that? You think if you're praying to Krishna, or some of you that feel Krishna may be reciprocating, but he's also doing it with like 50,000 other devotees at the same time. Even that's amazing, right? What to speak of all the other things, and what to speak of, he's fully absorbed in what he really wants to do, which is play in the forest in Vrindavan, you know? So the Vrindavan pastimes have as elements, are as human-like, they say, human-like pastimes. Playing with friends, son of Mother Yashoda, lover of the gopis. And sometimes he shows his omnipotence. Bhagavan, that also comes through at times. Like what? Killing demons. I mean, little child coward boy's not going to be killing demons, generally speaking. He shows his universal form to Mother Yashoda. Twice, I think, right? Twice he does. Two different pastimes. He lifts Govardhan Hill. That's when he's 7 years old. Is that just described? This is when they began to suspect that he might be something a little special. And then especially after Krishna, when Varuna steals Nanda Maharaj, brings about it, and then Nanda sees how Varuna, the god of all water, is like, you know, totally respectful, you know, glorifying Krishna a little bit, his little son Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then the final thing was when they're traveling, he has the coward man go in the water, and he reveals Goloka Vrindavan to them. And he's in Goloka Vrindavan as Krishna. So by that point, they're thinking, he's really something special, isn't he? And Nanda says, well, let me tell you, Ganga, you know, Gargamuni, that's him, thank you. Yeah, he's got a daughter named Gangi, but he's Gargamuni. Okay, Gargamuni in the name-giving ceremony explained all this, but he was very careful. He didn't want to tell them too much, you know, because he didn't want to disturb their rasa, their prema. So he said, your son, finally says, your son may be as good as Narayan. So he told this to the coward man. So they're thinking, oh, he may be empowered by Narayan. He may be an incarnation of God. You know, so many things. They think, oh, but anyway, he's very special. Now, does this disturb their prema, their rasa? Not really. Because Yoga Maya in the spiritual world acts to cover and protect the rasa and the love and the prema of the Rajavasis and all of his devotees everywhere. So they're not so disturbed even when Krishna shows his divinity. And Vishwanath Chakravarti was saying this, and Jiva Goswami said the same thing. They say, we are so fortunate. Krishna's our friend. Oh, aren't we fortunate that Krishna's our lover? You know, it's like, you know, it's like, okay. The gopis weren't always covered. A lot of times Krishna reveals himself, and sometimes they're aware that he's Krishna, that he who he is, but they don't really care. That's the amazing thing. He may or may not be God, but he's our dearmost lover. He's our sweetest, you know, he's Krishna. He says he's our darling, you know, fresh youth in Vrindavan, you know, and they're 100% totally dedicated to that, you know, completely just enwrapped in service. All the residents are, and so may or may not be God, okay, but that's not the important thing. It's interesting that sometimes in separation they tended to more think of him in the Aishvarya or as Bhagavan, but when in meeting, when they're with Krishna, that was all gone. You know, they'd immediately just be absorbed in that rasa, that relationship with Krishna, which was the most wonderful, sweetest, ecstatic thing possible. Okay, so Yoga Maya has several purposes in the spiritual world as well as material. She arranges Krishna's pastimes. Of course, Purnamasi is one of Yoga Maya's expansions that arranges all of these things in Vrindavan. She covers the intimate associates, as we're talking about, to enjoy the rasas, like the Damodar Leela. I mean, Mother Yashoda was quick. As soon as she actually was bewildered and uncomfortable, you know, with the whole seeing Krishna as a universal form in the mouth. So he immediately covers her back over. So, oh yes, so she can enjoy her relationship. Krishna allows Yoga Maya to cover him, even, so that he can enjoy pastimes. Chaitanya Charitamrita 429 purport says, Yoga Maya is the name of the internal potency that makes the Lord forget himself and become an object of love for his pure devotees in different transcendental mellows. Now, that's really interesting. Otherwise, if he's going to fully reciprocate with the love of his devotees, which he does, which he says he does, I mean, that's one of his main things, is he always reciprocates the love of his devotees. If he's just sort of play-acting, how would that really be reciprocation? No, he's got to get into it, right? He's got to get into the role, and not only that, he enjoys it. He wouldn't enjoy it very much either. The only way I've sort of thought about it, and I'm stealing this analogy, I think from Hridayananda Maharaj, is that it's like if you're the audience or you're even an actor in a play or a movie, you know, and you get really absorbed in it, you know, and you're totally absorbed in that role, even if you're watching someone. You know, and somebody comes up to you and bumps you and says, you know, that's not really, you're watching a play of Nishingadev or something. You know, that's not really Prahlad Maharaj. That's this kid that we know. You just say, be quiet. You're ruining the play. You're ruining, in other words, you want to be absorbed in, you know, in what's going on. You want to be absorbed in the relationships and the activity and like that, you know, and some, you know, it's like it completely ruins. So Krishna's like that. He's kind of like an actor in a play, but one who's like, what are they called, method acting? Someone you just get totally so absorbed in the part, you think you are that part. You are. Of course he is. It's not that he's thinking. See, that's why you can't, it's even hard to explain these things, you know, intellectually, you know, with our limited words. He is that. That is his original, you know, Krishna playing the flute, blackish blue, power boy. That is God. That is. It's not like, oh, God takes this role of Krishna. That is Krishna. That is his original Swayam Bhagavan, his original Sarup. So, I'm about it. I was thinking, oh, Prabhupada's also give an example. You know, the Supreme Court justice, you know, big man, or president of the United States, whoever it might be, comes home, he's there with his family. Do they kind of know he's the president of the Supreme Court? Do they care that much? Not that much. He's their father or a husband or whatever it might be. And he has relations. He's playing with the kids on the floor there. You know? So in other words, and he's probably enjoying that a lot more than this official position that he has to do every day, right? No, it's like that, kind of, sort of. I'm going to end with a really nice verse. This is from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adilita 152. By my causeless mercy, be enlightened in truth about my personality, manifestations, qualities, and pastimes. Purport, Srila Prabhupada. The transcendental personal forms of the Lord are a mystery, and the symptoms of these forms, which are absolutely different from anything made of mundane elements, is also mysterious. His uncommon activities, like lifting Govardhan Hill, marrying more than 16,000 queens at Dwarka, entering the Rasa dance with the damsels of Raja, expanding himself and in many forms as there were damsels in the dance, these and innumerable other uncommon acts and attributes are all mysteries. The truth of these mysteries was revealed to Brahma by the descending process without the help of the ascending one. Of course, when he's on the lotus. The Lord's mercy descends to a devotee like Brahma, and through Brahma to Narada, from Narada to Vyas, from Vyasadeva to Shukadeva, and so on in a bona fide chain of disciplic succession. We cannot discover the mysteries of the Lord by our mundane endeavors. They are only revealed by his grace to the proper devotees. And the last sentence, I think, is important for us to contemplate. These mysteries are gradually disclosed to the various grades of devotees in proportion to the quality, proportion to the gradual development of their service attitude. So, once again, we come back to the same simple process, sadhana bhakti, of, you know, hearing, chanting, remembering Krishna, serving Krishna with all of our energy, devoting our lives. And to the degree that that surrendering attitude is there, to that degree, Krishna will reveal himself to us by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada and Guru. Thank you very much. Jai. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. So we're... Question?
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Thank you for your nice class. A small comment and a question.
Okay.
Regarding this beautiful issue you bring up about how do we explain the Anchintya Shakti of the Lord? How can God lift a stone and yet not lift it? How can He the supreme controller and all-knowing and at the same time actually cry and mean it? A verse came to mind that's mentioned in the first verse of the 29th chapter of the 10th canto, the first verse of the first chapter of those five chapters of the Rasa Leela, where Krishna is said to have taken, fully takes shelter of his own yoga maya potency.
So he takes shelter.
He takes shelter. Yeah. Yeah, the actual Sanskrit is yoga mayam upashritaha.
Mm-hmm.
So we could, in a way, explain this by saying that God is able to simultaneously be, the supreme omniscient, supreme Lord, and so, and at the same time fully believe or fully be in character, as you say, as a crying child or as a lover of the gopis, by the agency of yoga maya, that he takes full shelter of.
Right.
Interesting.
Who is obviously coming from him ultimately.
Right.
It's, you know, his creation, but he allows himself to be put under the influence of Yogamaya. Even. And it's pretty amazing. Again, how do you understand that? Chinta Shakti. Mm-hmm. that's my answer to everything now. You don't get it, it's a Chinta Shakti.
Yeah. And my question, Prabhu, is regarding your question about experience. And you mentioned how a jiva cannot experience, you know, spiritual
everything.
Reality. And we hear, you know, Atakshi Krishna Navadi Na Bhavid Grayam Indriya, the Lord and so on cannot be perceived with the blunt material senses. What can you say, though? Can you say something about spiritual sense perception? You know, Krishna does talk about pratyaksha in the Gita, and as you mentioned, when we, as our scriptures say, when a soul engages in bhakti, then a revelation takes place. So can you say something about experiencing the revelation of God through one's spiritual sense?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, it's similar, but of course completely different at the same time. We all, you know, obviously, originally, or however you want to look at, you know, I don't want to get into that topic of, you know, the origin of the jiva. But let's just say we do have we have a spiritual body, we have spiritual senses. It's covered over now by the material body and senses. When those coverings are relieved, you know, by the process of bhakti, devotional service, then the spiritual body, the spiritual senses, and even spiritual mind intelligence, then it is revealed. In other words, it comes out. And with those spiritual senses and spiritual mind, the Atma can realize Krishna and be fully in relationship with Krishna and is enjoying and experiencing Krishna on that spiritual platform with the full spiritual senses and everything of one's siddha sarup, of one's spiritual body. And once one is situated in that original bhava, then it's perfect. There is no imperfection, as all of the defects that we talked about in the material world are not present. Material world, I can't remember. There's one nice verse about how in the spiritual world, there's no defects. There's, you know, none of these things are there. There's no effect of time, and, you know, in other words, it's. And Brahma Samhita, of course, also describes this a lot, how that's all going on very nicely. Now, it still doesn't, you know. In fact, it's interesting to talk about limitations. The pure spirit soul is much more unlimited. I mean, we can do a little bit. We have a little bit of movement, of freedom of action. You know, in other words, we do have some exertion or some influence on material energy. We can push it around a little bit, right? All of us can in these bodies that we're in. In the spiritual world, the spiritual bodies, much more unlimited. Well, Narada Muni is a good example. He can travel anywhere, material and spiritual worlds. Devotees can actually expand to multiple, you know, well, of course, it's a little different. I was thinking of Vishaka. Vishaka is kind of, she's probably Shakti Tattva. I don't think she's a direct expansion of Radharani. But anyway, Ramananda Roy is Vishaka, and says Sarup Damodar is a partial expansion of Vishaka also. And Arjuna was also, I think Ramananda Roy was also a partial expansion of Arjuna, as well as Vishaka. How does that happen? You know, this is some of the inconceivable points that even the living entity has. You know, of course, we're talking about now eternal, you know, people in a very, very high category, or even, I don't know. But at the same time, I don't know if I'm answering your question or I'm just starting to ramble now. I kind of got it. Okay, anything else? Oh, it's DTD.
I have the microphone, I'm sorry.
She's got the mic.
One time when Chaitanya Charan Prabhu was here and speaking on Radhastami, he pointed out that it's like Krishna is he writes the script, and then Yogamaya is the director.
Oh, that's good. Chaitanya Charan is brilliant at those.
Yeah.
I love his clothes.
He finds a way to...
Yeah, he writes the script, and then she... Although sometimes he doesn't know how the script's going to go. I was reading one pastime that where Krishna was saying, I wonder how Yogamaya is going to solve this one. You know, this is a real dilemma. How is she going to work this out? This will be interesting to see.
Maybe that was in the script, though.
Maybe that was in the script.
But also in Mayapur, Prabhupada told the devotees... on Vamandev's appearance day to choose one small boy, and they continue to do it to this day, about 5 or 6 years old, and they put him on the altar on a throne, and you know, with that umbrella and everything is there.
Really?
Yeah, he says, while you're doing that, and then they feed him unlimited amounts of Mahaprasad. Huh. He can have all that he wants. But it's a very sober pastime.
That's a very well-behaved boy, huh?
Yes, well, they're usually picked. Yeah, anyway. So, but and Prabhupada said, while he is playing that part, that is Vamandev.
Mm-hmm.
I think he did. He not say this regarding dramas that are performed as well. That, like Lord Nisringadev.
I don't remember that.
Okay, I will.
That was really interesting, though.
I'll take that back.
Okay. No, I don't know. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that about Vamandev. That's every year in Mayapur they do that. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this was discussed at a Govardhan retreat years ago, and Bharijana Prabhu gave the example that if I have someone that maybe they work for me or they're subordinate, I give them the keys to my car and I ask them to take me someplace. As soon as I give them the keys, they can do whatever they want. They can drive the car off a cliff. I have no control.
Right.
I own the car, mm-hmm. He's responsible to me, you know, so you could say I'm in control, because but technically, literally, I'm not in control. So he gave that example, and that Krishna allows Yogamaya, that actually Krishna turns over the keys to Yogamaya. So he's not, of course he's the Supreme Lord, but he gives up that control, and like you just said, he doesn't know necessarily what's going to happen. The cowherd boys do something. No, they don't do that. Well, now he has to figure out a way, because they did something, you know. And that helped me to at least, it's there's no way we can understand.
Well,
but that kind of helped say, wow, Krishna enjoys these pastimes so much that he wants to give up control out of love. He wants them to control him.
Exactly, and in fact, it, not just Yogamaya, but that kind of applies even to the jiva, to the atma, because ultimately, the atma has free will, has volition, has a certain ability to act. Jiva Goswami explains this in Paramatmasandarbha very thoroughly about how actually very, very empowered the atma is in its pure, in our pure state, And so, yeah, Krishna does give that. In fact, there's many, many verses where Krishna acts like, whatever my devotee does, that's, he said, they say it, so it's true, or I have to do it now. Since my devotee gave this curse or this blessing, I have to fulfill it. Yeah, there's this nice reciprocation where Krishna does allow his, although the devotee doesn't want to do anything except what Krishna wants, at the same time, Krishna likes that exchange. It's more intimate, or it's more, less awe and reverence. Krishna enjoys it more when there's less awe and reverence, and it is more, almost equal, like the cowherd boys, almost equal to him, like that kind of thing. Okay.
I was thinking, in Bhagavad Gita 7:26, it says, Vedaham samatitani vartamanani cha arjana bhavishyani cha bhutani mahanta vedana kaschan. I know past, I know future, I know present, but nobody knows me. So in Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur gives an explanation that if Krishna forgot himself that he is God, how is he God? That he's crying out of fear of Mother Yashoda. So in that sense, what Mother Ragatmika Devi stated, Chaitanya Chan Prabhu, actually Sanatana Goswami Path put that, I traced it, it was very nice. Mm-hmm. He said that Krishna subordinate himself under the love, not under the devotee, under the love of the devotee,
mm-hmm.
a particular love that devotee wants to reciprocate. So he subordinate put himself under for unrestricted and unlimited experience of that rasa,
mm-hmm.
of that transcendental taste. So he choose voluntarily, even though he says, oh, I don't know what to do. Actually, he wrote it, in a sense, that he wanted to experience that, but actually it is not possible Jogamaya do anything which is not his desire originally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's very interesting. That's why that concept is there. Like for an example, you gave the example of weather. This morning was a very frost and foggy. So weather may be bad, and I'll be driving from here to Gainesville. Well, I cannot control the weather. That Krishna controls. But as for my happiness in the car with the other devotee, that's not controlled by Krishna. So there is a boundary.
Yeah.
How far Krishna controls, how far we also have free will. Otherwise it is not has any value.
Well, yeah, and ultimately if we just say, well, Krishna is in control of everything and I have no independent, then we could take no responsibility for anything, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's all the Krishna. I didn't do it, you know. No, as you said, there's a balance. We are responsible for our actions, but of course, the more surrendered we are, the more we want those actions to be completely in line with Krishna's desire and Krishna's will.
Right. I also appreciate your wonderful explanation about Krishna's omniscience all the time with him. He knows everything at the same time. Simultaneously, his absorption to each individual reciprocation and he actually relishing. It seems like he completely forgot everything else. And he gives full attention to each individual when he's reciprocating. Simultaneously, that's him. He can be fully aware who is praying in Alachua or anywhere in the world. This is difficult. But for us to understand, that's why we should say inconceivable. I appreciate that.
Okay. All right, just riffing off that.
I think you get the last one here.
Oh, cool.
Last comment.
I can dig that. But just, I had a couple points. I had my own point, but just riffing off that, it's like you brought up the famous Prabhupada analogy of Gladstone, the Prime Minister. In the moment, he's playing with those kids. He's not worrying about foreign policy or anything else, you know, but it's not like he just forgets who he is if somebody comes in and says, you know, something happened. He's not, you know, he's there. But when he's with those kids, he's there with the kids, the loving exchange with those little kids. So it's the loving exchange that really is the guiding principle. Having said that, I got a technical thing that has nothing to do with rasa, but the idea of the earth as a globe is not a modern thing. You know, even within the Vedic tradition, within the Western traditions, we have manuscripts thousands of years old where they've been doing calculations of the earth as a globe that the moderns think are pretty accurate. So it was pretty well known all through time. And similarly, in the modern times, people still debate, you know, it's flat. So it could be, you know, it's not like the idea the earth is flat is essential to the ancient world and the idea the earth is a globe is essential to the modern
world.
No,
okay, yeah.
Yeah,
I think that's... I'll accept that.
Because one thing
is
when you do Jyotisha calculations, the birthplace is important because the night sky on a globe is different. You know, if you're on a globe, you're here, the night sky's a little different than if you're on a globe.
Well, that's all the Vedic knowledge.
Vedic Brahmins have been calculating the earth as a globe for thousands of years.
Yeah.
We have manuscripts. So, nothing new under the sun, according to the Christians.
Okay. Thank you all very much. I'll go to the ship.